Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Heather McNarr. Heather McNarr teaches English at Chatham University. Her chapbook, entitled Panic and Joy, was published by Finishing Line Press in 2008. Her full-length collection, System of Hideouts, will be published this winter from Main Street Rag. Hi, Heather, how are you?
Okay.
Really happy that you're here. We've been planning this for a while.
It's true. I'm honored to be here.
As we are to have you. So you're going to start with something from your chapbook.
Yeah. People seem to like this poem, so I'll begin. I could never have a daughter. God help me if she dates men or women like her mother, flighty and demanding, hot to trot to tramp over the amber coals of her lovers' hearts. I could never have a daughter. What if she was raped, or stupid, or shallow? What if she rolls her eyes, my eyes, and yawns in the 11th hour of Brideshead Revisited? What if she hates herself, refuses food, deflecting warmth, arms, devotion, shunning our face in the mirror? What if she doesn't read, as I did not, and did not, and did not, until one day I did? It wasn't up to you, Mom. I could never have a daughter. What if she loves me and hates me the way I love and love my mother until it burns to look or swallow? What if it's up to me and she listens to a word I say? And this is called Gathering, and it's in it you'll hear sort of the title track of Panic and Joy. Gathering. What we can never hold is winter, snow, the dust from the forest or room or street where you first fell in love, ash from 1987 cigarette, the brash, cagey howl of Laurie Anderson's electric violin, the first time you died from sound, spine blinking, hello. Or your panic and joy, watching Annie Lennox, learning a Windsor knot from a woman, knowing for sure you're fine. Your whole life, you will be able to hold not a single one of the moments that made you. So you write, desperate, breathless, blessed. Okay, and this is a relatively new poem, and it's in the new book coming out this winter. It's called Cleveland 83. You arrive with lice and are assigned the seat of a ghost. There's no school bus here, so no one's punched or screwed you yet. At recess, you study the sixth graders who, in their rugby shirts, have survived. The walk home is that nightmare in which you are chased as 1,000 leashless dogs sniff out the new trembling 9-year-old. The apartment is asylum. Inside, it's a rough bath where, with enough will, you purge your scalp of lice, then vigilantly wipe from the tub your tiny gossamer holocaust. This poem has nothing to do with your mother, who's at work, testing junkies and homos in the new Holocaust. The CDC pamphlets she brings home are atrocities from which you cannot look away, high gloss, herpetic, full-blown. These are the longest days of your life. It is safe to say you are still living them. Eventually, toward dinner time, you do what you came to do, Ziggy Stardust and American Graffiti. Funny, the things that save our lives. At the turntable, you kneel and sing. You sing and you sing. You're a kid, sad, but not unhappy. At night, from bed, you whisper 10 serenity prayers and 10 Lord's prayers, the only prayers you know. In the end, you will live here less than half of the eternity that is your 10th year, and you will meet God. You have not one other choice.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Heather McNarr, reading some new poems and reading from her chapbook entitled Panic and Joy. Oh, I wanted to ask you, Heather, about your new book. First of all, congratulations
Thank
on
you.
It. Yeah. So, and the great title, which is System of Hideouts.
Correct.
Published by Main Street Rag this coming winter.
Yeah, this winter. I'm not sure when yet.
Okay, so maybe 2012.
Yeah, I'm thinking January, but.
Okay. Yeah, it's hard to say.
Right.
Can you talk about a little bit about what's coming in your new book and if anything has shifted in the newer poems?
I think there's a steady theme of emptiness and loneliness. But again, in the poem I just read about being a kid, sad but not unhappy, I'm hoping that there's a hopefulness too in the poems where there's sort of an embracing of some loneliness and some emptiness, even if in some of the poems I'm resisting it too.
Mm-hmm.
Just sort of traveling around in that space when you're sort of on your own, you know. In your mm-hmm. in your adult life, and it's rather stunning that you've made it this far to your middle to late 30s.
And now what? Yeah. Well, it seems to me that there's always this urgency in your work. You had a line in one of the poems you've read, the things that save us, and that gender figures prominently here. Do you feel that sense of urgency in your writing? The need to write.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's the only reason I do it, really. I resist doing it. I have poems about that. But my life tends to get really crooked really fast when I'm resisting what I need to do, which is express it. So.
Okay. Do you feel any pressure to write poems of gender, or is that just what comes?
Not yet. I would love to feel pressure because it would mean somebody's reading, you know, some more people are reading it. It's sort of a luxury position to get pigeonholed a little bit. But so far it comes and it doesn't. I try to write, you know, just whatever I need to write that day,
mm-hmm.
genderless or not. So.
Right. And remember, it's that thing where you don't know who's reading you or how many people, mm-hmm. you know, are waiting for the next poem. You do readings in the world, and there's probably a lot of people out there waiting for what you're doing next.
Oh, that's sweet. Thank you. That's very optimistic. I hope so.
Well, no, I think it's just real. Yeah. You know, there's no way to know these people because a lot of them won't come up to you, but they're there.
Yeah, so. That's true.
Yeah, I believe that. Definitely. Can you read some more poems Are you reading new stuff?
Yeah, I'm reading stuff that's in the new book, mostly because the chapbook came out a while ago, and I don't want to say I'm sick of those poems, but I've read them a lot. So,
and yet a lot of us haven't heard them.
That's
so
true. Yeah,
but go ahead, whatever you'd like.
Okay, I actually am going to read next a poem that Jan, you picked up for City Paper, which was a really great event for me. It's called Washer and Dryer. Today, the washer and dryer arrive. You've spent the week preparing the area like it's a nursery. The delivery guys are on the friendly side. You drop the steely name of your brother, but stop at a boyfriend or husband who, if it comes to that, returns this afternoon from Afghanistan in time for the game. It never gets that far, except in your head, where it is always exactly that far. After they go, you stand in your basement and preside over your first washer and dryer in your first house. Later, you'll wander down again and again to gaze at your washer and dryer, gleaming white and waiting. But nothing shakes it. You're a woman, home alone. The next one I'm going to read is called The Precise Moment of Takeoff. I was tempted to name the new collection this, but that was voted no. The precise moment of takeoff. When the falcon I've read about in the paper swoops past, I leap from my chair and follow, one window, one room to the next. It lands on that tree over there. Together we wait. She on her branch, I in my bedroom. She is perfect stillness, my falcon, and goes on being perfect stillness for 1 minute, two, three. I need to see her fly again to learn how exactly she breaks stillness with flight. I'm not here for stillness. I'm here for the grand, imperceptible unlatching, the precise moment of takeoff, the shuddering in between. But my falcon, she takes too long. I chew a thumbnail, stretch my hamstrings along the snarling radiator, sigh a diminutive planet on the dirty pane. Whatever it is I want, I don't want it badly enough to wait another goddamn minute, watching what is, wanting more. And then I'm going to read System of Hideouts. And this starts with a quote by a rabbi named Martin Buber, who wrote a book called The Way of Man. And the quote is, "To escape responsibility for his life, he turns existence into a system of hideouts." To avoid writing poems, I go to therapy, where she rubs her hands together and exclaims, "I love emptiness. Do you know why?" The question's not rhetorical. I mumble thinly, "No, why?" She can't wait to tell me, because only in emptiness are poems born. To avoid writing poems, I worked at the Whole Foods, where Morgan, moon-faced and flip, asked me, "So Heather, how's the writing?" Here's a tip. Never ask a writer about her writing unless you want a nice fat lip. 3 years later, my mother in the car inquired, "Are your poems less angry than they used to be?" To avoid writing poems, I went to the grocery store and found a new girlfriend in the cookie aisle. We bought toothbrushes, and together we left the state. There are, naturally, less extreme tactics. 6 feet under, taekwondo, pizza, ice cream, the internet, alcohol, home remodeling, library school, The Wire, The West Wing, a dozen or so prerequisites toward a career in chiropractic. But romance and state hopping, preferably together, are the most effective and lasting. When you look down 4 years later, maybe you're pulling on your socks, blue and yellow argyles, and it occurs to you, "These aren't even my socks. These are my ex-girlfriend's ex-boyfriend's socks. Nothing I own is mine, and anyway, I hate Seattle. How on earth did I get here, and how the hell do I get back?" The question that will linger like a tapeworm is, how many poems and books of poems might I have written instead? To avoid writing poems, I, is Wednesday's workshop prompt, and the one we all call Swatson affirms coolly, "Avoidance, it's a lifestyle." The class agrees it's why they smoke, why not to live alone. Meanwhile, I take my fist, bang my sternum and explain, "Poems live here. How every day the choice remains, cleave to aisle number 7's collarbones or to the poem, boneless and real."
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Heather McNarr. And she's reading some new poems from her soon-to-be-published collection, System of Hideouts, which will be published by Main Street Rag. So I really like that last poem.
Thanks.
Nice title poem. And some of it, you know, rings so true, you know, how to avoid writing. And,
yeah, absolutely.
And I really appreciate that. Please don't ask a writer, "How's the writing going?" It's like, or when people say, "Are you writing?" I'm like, "Of course I'm writing. I'm a writer, but I'm writing right now."
Or if you say no, which often, most of the year, I'm like, "No, actually, I'm not." It's like this moral failing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, feel shame,
yeah.
Shame. And really, the person is just interested.
Right.
And so it's not right. It's not right. But, but yeah, thanks for writing that.
Sure.
I want to ask you about the sound in your poems. There's such beautiful sound that seems to be interwoven you know, it doesn't seem to act as the driving force in the poem. But for example, just some bits that I've noticed, gossamer holocaust, mm-hmm. you know, snarling radiators, you know, these unexpected word choices that are full of sound and sometimes make the mouth do a lot of work in a good way. Can you talk about the importance of sound in your work?
Sure. Well, I think I probably came to poetry as a pre-adolescent in love with music, in love with all that early 80s pop, right? And the sound of things was really important to me. And also, I love reading my work aloud. I think it's the way you want your poetry, not just literally, but I think spiritually. I always stress to my students how important that performative piece is. And so, yeah, the sound is, if not the primary thing I'm going for, it's definitely when I start revising and reading aloud to revise, it's what I'm paying attention to the most.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Another thing I was noticing is this idea of politics. It keeps coming up and up again. Again, it doesn't seem to be, you know, it's not the heavy-handed, overt political poem, and yet in that laundry poem, mm-hmm. there's that, you know, Afghanistan comes in. Mm-hmm. In the, what was the other poem? The use of the word Holocaust mm-hmm. a couple times in that mm-hmm. other poem. Mm-hmm. So it just keeps rising up in your work. How do you feel about, I mean, do you view the personal as political and not to
yes.
get into,
yes,
okay.
I do. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And mostly the washer and dryer poem started as a poem about a washer and dryer and a woman owning her first home, but really it's about fear.
Mm-hmm.
It's about fear, and that is, it's deeply political to me, whether we want to acknowledge it or not.
Right, right. Yeah, that's what I was sort of thinking. I mean, your poems feel very political to me, and sometimes the overt detail comes through, and yet it's all through there. Is that also a driving force for your writing?
Well, I think the personal part kicks the poem off. But one of the ways that I know that I'm a poet, or I know that that my poetry speaks to other people, is because I know I'm not alone in feeling that fear, or framing certain political things that are maybe start off as personal. I know I'm not alone in that. And poets have an opportunity and an obligation to say those things,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
which is also, I think, the act of writing poetry and speaking it out loud is political also.
Yeah, I agree with you, especially as a woman. I'd like to hear more poems.
Sure. I'm going to actually read another one from Panic and Joy, because you've made me so reinterested in my book here. So thank you. I'm going to read a poem called Looking Down, and then I'll read a poem called Looking Up. Looking Down. Without the ice, the pond was nothing. No poem. The ice was the spindly light. The ice was the difference by which we judge the dark. The ice shone everything, gave it all away, and told the poem of just how dark, and the kind of dark we're dealing with. Looking up. A river and its teeth are talking about you. The water's confidences broach in pencil. The sky this morning wants to be the river. You don't blame it. You dream in pencil. Your teeth pour like salt from your mouth. And I think I'll switch over to a new poem. This poem is so new, it's not in any book or journal yet. And it's my attempt to be a little Ed Ochester. Seattle, 1995. At the bus stop early one morning on 15th Street, we half dozen strangers stand. Some of us still smoke, some of us hungover, at least one of us still drunk, most of us white, all of us sleepily clutching our 16-ounce cups. We stand and watch without really seeing The well-dressed lady opened the door of her well-dressed car, get in and pull away. On the roof, her own 16-ounce cup and her purse. We wave and shout in anthem, "Hey lady, your coffee." True story. It's this, the Seattle story that I love to tell. And this is another really new one. It's called Teaching Moby Dick. I tell them that in 11th grade, Kathy Jo, whose father was a pharmacist, snuck in before class and stickered every one of our public school copies with those alarming orange warnings, may cause drowsiness. I tell them, you too can live the dream without it. I tell them I couldn't be bothered that year, opted instead to have sex every afternoon with Carson in the Eaton Park bathroom, because from Taylor Alderdice High School, it was exactly halfway to her bed, and because we couldn't wait. We used the handicap stall, one of us on the tank, the other standing faced forward to give the women who walked in the illusion of a single pair of boots, our jeans undone so our hands could reach in and offer the devil's quick, clenched, silent work. And this one is called Double Life. It's probably the newest poem I've written. Never was there a problem that couldn't be solved by two bowls of cereal in quick succession. This is McNair wisdom, the men at least. Ian, Rob, my dad, solid and unsinister as club chairs. Me, I always needed a little more help. 2 six-packs, 2 days straight on a bar stool, 2 girlfriends at once, 2 advanced degrees, 2 sobriety dates, 2 bicycles, then 3, then 4 in pieces in my basement, 2 residences, this perfectly lovely home with her and the immaculate cat-free condo at the corner of Neville and Fifth, where each day I hide with 2 hoagies, 2 cokes, 2 pints of coffee Heath Bar Crunch, 2 seasons of Veronica Mars. Home thinks I'm at work. Work thinks I'm at home. No one can find me. Nobody knows till I die, when they discover the deed and the questions fall out one after the other like matchbooks from a suit coat. But by then, I'll have had enough.
Nice poem.
Thank you.
Can you say anything about how the craft may be changing with your new work? It seems to me that the voice in these new poems seems to be a little louder, maybe a little stronger.
I'm more interested suddenly in telling a story, and I absolutely think that has to do with going to Ed Ochester readings and readings that you actually, when you and Ed read sort of in tandem, this sort of dual style reading at Chatham 2 years ago now, that was poem altering for me. You know, it started to alter what I wanted to do with my poems. You're both very confident up there speaking a story, you know, and I want that.
Well, Ed is really something. And, you know, one thing that I keep going back to in his work is this, as Judy Vollmer talks about it, the courage to say things plainly. And I keep seeing that again and again in his work. And I keep, you know, wondering, how does he do this? How does he do this? And it's hard to do. It's very hard to do, of course. He's amazing.
How do you say it plainly and still have it be a poem?
Yes.
How do you have it sing at the same time?
Yeah. Have it be compelling
That's
and urgent.
My new struggle, and I welcome it. I do.
So. Yeah. And I remember teaching Ed Ochester's book in my class and making them write a craft paper, and they struggled so hard because the craft in Ed Ochester's work is everywhere, and yet it's subtle and all connected, and I think drove them a little crazy.
Yeah.
So,
so
that's what you're talking about, and yet I feel that movement in the new poems, and it sounds great.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay, we have time for a little bit more.
Okay. All right, this poem's called Affirmations. I'm very attached to it, which I mistrust, but I read it at every reading. So, Affirmations. I want your relationship to die, and yours, and yours, and yours too. Divorce, break up, move out are verbs for giddy. At the table beside me, a toddler wears glasses. Pink James Joyce frames, a patch over one eye. She manages a tub of grapes and a picture book called Baby Wild Animal. Somebody's cut each green grape in half for her. Her new potato fists carry the miracle half moons one after the other into her darling, determined Joey mouth. Last night, the lesbian folk singer from Durham made me cry. I hope no one saw, and I hope no one lays her hand flat against my heart as she grazes my earlobe and sighs. Are you okay? World, your guitars and your children, tell them, please, to stop. My first answer to any question is no, never. My advice is dump him, dump him, dump her, dump the dog, too. Nothing elates me more than leaving. Her collarbones were less delicious than being right via telephone. Talk to me. Tell me about caring for an aging parent. I say dump her. Dump that mother in a home. I will manage to avoid the mayhem and folly that others have not managed to avoid. Trust is for chumps. Meanwhile, at the table, this child of the unbroken posture and Arthur onesie, her koala back is the breadth of one hand. I know because I reach out and almost bear it.
We have time for one more short one.
Oh, good. Okay. I'm going to read the opener to my new book. It's called First Time. Until that afternoon, I had never slept like that. Like a boy after sledding. In your twin bed, I had never even heard of flannel sheets, and later, when you woke me, I had never been wakened by a girl's velveteen mouth. Later, I would feel for the first time you lathering with lotion my chapped, embarrassed legs. They were virgins. They sang out, bee stings in snow.
The poetry of Heather McNarr. Thank you so much.
Sure, thank you for having me. A pleasure.
It was great. You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment news weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in at our new time, Saturday mornings at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 FM.